You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This week, we pick up with our Summer of Zelazny, continuing on into the fall with it a little bit, because we did two great Roger Zelazny memorial panels at conventions over the summer and early fall. One was at Dragon Con. I do not have a recording of it, though it went very well, big crowd. But the other, I think, went even better, and we did it at Archon in St. Louis in October. And so I am now going to present, pretty much in its entirety, the Roger Zelazny memorial panel from Archon in St. Louis in October of 2015. This was the 20th anniversary, as those of you who follow the show know. This year is the 20th anniversary of the passing of the great science fiction fantasy writer Roger Zelazny. And so we held a panel at both of those aforementioned conventions to talk about his life and his work and really dig down into his work and just sort of geek out on it for about an hour. And the audience was very enthusiastic about that, and we had a great time. I think you'll enjoy hearing it. So without further ado, here is the Roger Zelazny Memorial Panel from Archon. Enjoy. We are convened here today to remember what I consider the greatest science fiction fantasy crossover writer ever. The biggest influence on my work, certainly.
Mine too.
And my favorite writer, Roger Zelazny. He passed away in 1995 of cancer. Came on him suddenly, and they couldn't do much. And so it's been 20 years. It's hard to imagine 20 years since that happened. So, Walt, you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then I'll introduce myself.
Yeah, it's amazing to remember that Zelazny died at 56 years old, having won 6 Hugo Awards, 3 Nebula Awards, 2 Locus Awards, 1 pre-Tour Apollo Award, 2 Seiyun Awards, and 2 Balrog Awards.
Yeah.
He was really a great, great author. He's done more to influence the way I write than anybody. I'm Walt Boies. Currently, I'm the editor of the Grantville Gazette, which is the 1632 Universe magazine. I have two stories coming out in this new anthology, Dogs and Dragons, which will be out November 15th. I have a story in Gazette 7 and one in all the Ring of Fire series. And my day job, I'm the editor and publisher of the Industrial Automation Insider, which is a magazine devoted to automation and manufacturing, the Internet of Things and smart manufacturing. As an editor, it's fascinating to me to go back. I keep digging the Zelaznys out of my trunks, and I keep praying that more of them will wind up as e-books.
Yes.
Unfortunately, although Roger was one of the very first people who got interested in putting electronic books together, his estate has been so messed up for 20 years that very few of his books are available on Kindle.
Nine Princes just came out a couple of months ago.
Yes.
And that's the only one.
And it's just as good as I remembered it. He did things with the English language that were incredible. He was an expert, by the way, on Elizabethan drama. He got his PhD in Elizabethan drama with a dissertation on Turner. And you can see that in his writing. The the turn of phrase, all kinds of things like that. One of the things that he did that was incredible, and it snuck up on you, you didn't notice that he was doing it, was he would very often start a chapter at the end. And then he would write backwards to the beginning. He did that in Eye of Cat, most noticeably. Or at least that's when I first noticed he was doing it.
He loved to experiment. I mean, he was always doing something. Everything he ever wrote was an experiment in some new approach, some new form, some new style. I mean, there's like, I guess it's road marks where he wrote all chapter ones and chapter twos, put them in envelopes, sealed them, shuffled them all up, and then had it published in that order that it came out of the envelopes. And it works.
It works beautifully.
Everything he did was an attempt to do something new and always pushing the boundaries. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I write new pulp, science fiction, fantasy, the Sentinel Superheroes, and the Shattering Space Opera. The two books that I have written that most heavily bears Elazzi's imprint, although honestly almost everything does, Lucian, Dark God's Homecoming, and Baranek Storming the Gates, both of those are really, I mean, Lucian was me trying to see if I could write a book like the Amber books, but with my own story, my own characters and everything, but in the same flavor. Baranek, for that, I wrote it earlier this year, and what I did, I've got all the Amber books on unabridged audio. I've got I've got the hardcover things we'll talk about in a bit. I've got them all. I've read them a million times, but I went back and got the oldest copies of the paperbacks, and I read them. I read the first five, the Corwin cycle, all the way through. And when I got to Courts of Chaos, I knew exactly how Baranek was going to go, and so I wrote Baranek with Courts of Chaos sitting beside me, just like Corwin drew the second pattern while thinking of the Champs-Élysées in Paris in the springtime and everything. The Courts of Chaos was my Champs-Élysées when I was writing Baranek. So it's that much in the DNA, absolutely in the DNA. So, I'll mention these here. I brought just one example. I don't know, in case everybody doesn't know, assuming you're all Elazzi fans, or why would you be here? The New England Science Fiction Association, NESFA Press, put out six volumes plus an annotated bibliography a couple of years ago in gorgeous hardcover with a Michael Whelan art that stretches across all six books of all of his short stories, all of his poetry, or a lot of his poetry, everything except the whole novels, and there's even pieces of some of the novels in them. So if there's, a short story you've never been able to track down, it's in here, along with a lot of commentary, different introductions, all kind of stuff in here. There's a six-part running biography of him that was done by, you just get a little bit of everything. Joe Haldeman did the introduction for this volume. Stephen Bruce has an introduction in this volume. I mean, there you go. And then
Christopher Kovacs.
Yeah, Chris Kovacs wrote the Call Me Roger, the literary life of Roger Zelazny. So, this is a guy that you guys, before we started, were mentioning This Immortal, Call Me Conrad. This Immortal tied Dune for the Hugo, okay? Mm-hmm. His little thin fix-up book where he took a short story and said, I'll add a few more pages to it, and it freaking tied Dune. That's mind-blowing. I'm like, yeah.
How many of you read A Night in the Lonesome October every October? I do.
That's a good idea.
I do. Because it has 31 chapters.
Right.
Each corresponding to a day in October. It's told by the dog.
Yeah, Snuff.
Snuff, the dog. I know a lot of people who do that as a Halloween tradition. They start on October 1st.
That's good.
And they read the thing all the way through to
the
31st.
Yeah.
I do it every year. It sits on the back of the toilet in our bathroom so that I remember to do it every morning. So that I do it.
Good idea.
One of the things that just amazes me. Well, there's also this. I can't pick it up because you get your you get your recorder sitting on it. But Lord of Light,
yes,
which also won the Hugo.
Yeah.
Supposedly is based on a bet between Zelazny and Robert Silverberg that Zelazny could not write a novel based on a pun.
God. Oh, it's got the greatest horrible pun in literary history in it.
And he wrote Lord of Light around this pun, and it won the Hugo. The pun is, and the fit hit the Shan.
Yep.
He created a character named the Shan of Arabic. Had him go to the temple and get his new body. Since they thought that the Shan of Arabic was really Sam Calkin, the hero, they gave him a defective body. So he's riding along and Sam says, and how are things going? And then the fit hit the Shan. He wrote that whole thing just so that he could say that. And it is one of the most inventive novels of the 1970s.
That was not only my introduction to Zelazny, that was my introduction to the entire Hindu everything. I mean, that's where I first encountered all that stuff.
He had incredible ideas. And that's not fantasy. That's science fiction.
But with the trappings of fantasy, that was what he was so good at, was kind of blending the two or using the trappings of one in the other. Like his magic systems in Mad Wand and Changeling are very scientific seeming. And his science in his science fiction stuff, which he did more when he was younger, have a lot of fantasy trappings. He wouldn't just blend them together. He would keep them discreet, but they had the trappings of the other, you know. So that it gave you both in a way.
Yeah, the machine that Render the Shaper uses to get into your dreams and things like that is on the far side of possible now.
Yeah.
So it really was science fiction.
That's the book that became Dreamscape, the movie. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get a credit in it for whatever reason, but it was based on...
If I remember correctly, he didn't like it, and he told him to take his name off. Or something like that. But he was just so prolific and in so many ways and doing so many different things. His take on being God-ridden in the Isle of the Dead and to die in Itabar is pretty interesting. He posits an alien religion with a group of aliens who are the oldest aliens around, and they're dying off because they haven't got anything left to do. And so the gods in this pantheon start taking humans as their avatars, and what they allow if you're the avatar of one of these gods, you can shape worlds. You can become a worldscaper, and it's a fantastic story. I wish he had written more of them. Francis Sandow is a really fascinating character.
There is a Francis Sandow short. I don't remember its name, but there is one.
It escapes me.
It happens between the two books, I think.
Yeah, I remember that, and I've only read it once. I can't find it now.
Somewhere in the house, but I don't have it in my database.
Yeah.
Isle of the Dead is one that I actually sat down with, and with a pencil, and just tried to deconstruct how he did it, because that's the one that starts. I mean, again, experimental, and he could get away with stuff that nobody else could get away with. Like beginning of the first three pages of Isle of the Dead, he starts out. I mean, this just blows my mind. The beginning of Isle of the Dead, he says, "What is it? Is a time, or I forget what he starts out with, is something that's very much like Tokyo Bay."
Yeah.
And then he goes on for three pages to talk about the stuff that washes up on the shores of Tokyo Bay. And then he goes back to what he was starting to talk about in the very first word. right? And I mean, you're thinking, any of us wrote that, the agent or publisher would be like, this is taking too long to get started. No, you need to throw that beginning out and hit the ground running. He just starts with this conversation about flotsam and jetsam, right? Garbage. Used condoms and pieces of dead bodies, you know, and whatever, and you're just like, what? Where is he going? You know, and he just takes his time getting there, but you trust him. You know it's going somewhere good.
And Isle of the Dead is available as an ebook.
Is it?
It's combined with Eye of Cat.
Okay.
Which is
that's
great.
This is an odd combination, but
well, that's what Byron Price did.
Yeah.
When he put it together, and that's why the only so few of them are together, because Byron got killed.
Right.
The Isle of the Dead. Starts.
I know it. I'm just blanked out on the first word. It's like time is a thing that is very. I guess it's time, right? Time is a thing that
it
is.
Must be if because of his own time stream.
Yeah, he says something like time is a thing that if you'll forgive me a quick digression is very much like what washes up on the shore of Tokyo Bay.
Quick digression.
Yeah. The fact that we know these things is kind of pretty. It says a lot, right? You're talking about his awards. I wanted to say right quick. He had that period where the nebulas liked him, which was early on, right? When he mm-hmm. and he won all of his nebulas within like a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he went up against himself in a couple of categories. I want to say he won like novella and novelette both in the same year, because one story was a little longer than the other, so he won for both in two different categories. But the nebulas are fickle, and they moved on to other people. But he had a second run with the Hugos where he kind of came back, I want to say in the late 70s, early 80s, and racked up a few more Hugos. So he ended up with 6 Hugos and 3 Nebulas.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Nebulas never did, after his initial, you know, his initial stories, they liked his short stories.
I found the first paragraph. Let me, if you like, I'll
sure.
read it. Life is a thing.
Life is a thing.
If you'll excuse a quick dab of philosophy before you know what kind of picture I'm painting, that reminds me quite a bit of the beaches around Tokyo Bay. Now, it's been centuries since I've seen that bay and those beaches, so I could be off a bit, but I'm told it hasn't changed much except for the condoms from the way that I remember it. I remember a terrible expanse of dirty water, brighter and perhaps cleaner way off in the distance, but smelling and slopping and chill close at hand, like time when it wears away objects, delivers them, removes them. Tokyo Bay on any given day is likely to wash anything ashore. You name it, and it spits up some other time or other. A dead man, a shell that might be alabaster, rose and pumpkin bright, with a sinister whirling, rising inevitably to the tip of a horn as innocent as the unicorns. A bottle, with or without a note, which you may or may not be able to read, a human fetus, a piece of very smooth wood with a nail in it, maybe a piece of the true cross. I don't know. And white pebbles and dark pebbles, fishes, empty dories, yards of cable, corals, seaweed, and those are pearls that were his eyes. Like that. You leave the thing alone, and after a while, it takes it all away again. That's how it operates. Oh, yeah. It also used to be lousy with condoms, limp and almost transparent testimonies to the instinct to continue the species,
but not today.
And sometimes they were painted with snappy designs or sayings, and sometimes they had a feather on the end. These are almost all gone now, I hear, the way of the Edsel, the Clepsydra, and the button hook, shot down and punctured by the safety pill, which makes for larger mammaries, too, so who complains?
That was almost like one sentence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He would do that. There's one of the Amber books where an entire page is you start, you're already in the middle of a sentence, and the entire page is that sentence, and it continues on to the next page.
And he makes you like it.
Yeah. Because anybody could do that. He does it well. Right?
Yeah.
He does it where you want to read it. Don't go away.
That's an e-book.
Yes.
Nook or Kindle or both?
Both.
Good.
And that's why I can read it, because
I figured you had one of the apps there.
Yeah, I have a Kindle app on this iBook. But that's the way he wrote. One of the things that I love, and the reason I think that, and Call Me Conrad, or This Immortal, which mm-hmm. was the novel's title, tied with Dune,
mm-hmm.
was because it was funny as hell, and yet it hit you.
Yeah,
his dog Bortan, who was the last dog on Earth, and who is the size of a boar, and he's armor plated.
It's been a long time since I read that one, so I've almost completely have to go back.
And the Vagan, Conrad Nomikos is director of monuments for the EarthGov, which doesn't live on Earth. The EarthGov and most of the people of Earth have moved to Vega because the Vagans have taken them in after the big war where we bombed ourselves into near oblivion. Conrad gets told by the EarthGov that this famous and very rich Vagan poet, Kort Mystigo, is coming to look at the Earth, and the resistance tells him that Kort has to be killed because he's going to do something bad to the Earth. So his job becomes to keep Kort Mystigo alive. And he does things like have the pyramids taken down. And Mystigo says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm making a documentary." "What do you mean?" He said, "You'll notice that there are people over there falling down very slowly and getting up very quickly. And you'll notice that we're numbering each one of the bricks." He said, I'm going to edit it and run it in reverse, and it'll be called Building the Great Pyramids." He said, "And then if I have enough money left over in my budget, I'll put the pyramid back up." Kort dies and tells, and his last will says, "I'm leaving Earth to you, Conrad. You are now the owner of Earth because you really are a Kalakansaros, and you are immortal, and you will be around a while to take care of Earth, which I care about a lot." It's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
It's about 130 pages, maybe. This immortal. It is, and it is also available on Kindle.
That really hits on a big theme of his, which is the immortal. I love that he often had the very smart alecky, immortal, godlike protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
In different pantheons, you know, even with Amber, his own pantheon. You know,
I liked it that he picked out like the Hindu pantheon.
Yeah,
but he did a lot.
He did, and several others that he did, whatever, that really brought. You know, I really liked what he did with them, his interpretation on mm-hmm. how bringing them into the modern day.
Sure.
There are godlike beings in some ways, are avatars of them.
Yeah, you have the Hindu gods, and then Buddha shows up. It's awesome. It's perfect.
Creatures of Light and Darkness.
The Egyptian.
The Egyptian pantheon.
Eye of Cat's Native American.
Eye of Cat is Native American.
What was the...
The Sandow duology is a alien pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
Damnation Alley is also available as a Kindle book.
Where I was going with the character though is you have this usually this immortal smart ugly character, and I like that there's a thread that runs through history through literary history of that character, and Zelazny embraced it and did a lot with it. I kind of take it back. I mean, I'm sure it goes back even further, but the first time I really encountered it is Edgar Rice Burroughs with John Carter. John Carter is a Zelazny hero mm-hmm. because he's a sword fighter and he's immortal. And he's had other lives on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The people, you know, not to digress too far, but it's the same thread. It's, you know, people think of John Carter as that guy who went to Mars, to Barsoom, but he's actually the immortal, eternal warrior who just happens to be in those stories going to Mars. And he does it. We don't see the other stories that, you know, where he did other things, but it's very, you know, Burroughs lays out that he's lived for a long time and will live for a long time. Philip Jose Farmer, I think, is also in that thread.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Zelazny was the first to admit that because there's no doubt that a huge influence on Amber was World of Tears. And, you know, where a guy finds out he's an immortal, godlike being who can create universes, which is what Corwin does, right? All the princes can create their own universes, more or less. That's up for debate in the books.
Right.
And
do we create it or do we find it?
Right. And Zelazny certainly owns up to that, because he actually dedicates one of the Amber books to the main character in the World of Tears.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can just follow that thread. I've always said, I mean, I love Philip Jose Farmer tremendously, but I feel like what Zelazny did was take the Farmer stuff, even though Farmer outlived him by many years, obviously, but I kind of think of Farmer as predating literarily.
He did.
Zelazny.
I agree.
Is that Zelazny took what Farmer was already doing and made it poetic,
mm-hmm.
made it even more literary.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not to take anything away from Farmer, but it's just to say that Zelazny brought a poet's soul mm-hmm. to that little subgenre almost.
I just found out that book two of the Chronicles of Amber was released on September 27th as a Kindle book.
It is out. Okay, they're Guns
of Avalon is out now.
New cover art, too.
Yes, new cover
There's
art.
There's never been good Amber cover art. They do knights on plate mail. Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
Corwin in silver armor with a machine gun. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I want to see. That machine gun. That's it, man. Yep. That's what. When I was a kid and I first read the Corwin cycle, you're like, yeah, it's okay. First, it's contemporary, but he's a victim kind of, and he's kind of mm-hmm. taking control of his life. He's got amnesia, which is an awesome beginning, best beginning ever. And then it becomes kind of a fantasy thing when they take the car. He and Random take the car. But when they get the machine guns, I'm like, now this is something I've never seen before.
Yeah.
They're shooting griffins with machine guns. It's almost like something you'd see on Stargate later on, you know, where they got the Earth people with machine guns fighting the aliens and stuff. I was just like, wow. Yeah.
My son is 20 now, and I guess about 6 years or so ago, he was looking for something to read, so I handed him the first book, Nine Princes in Amber.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And Susie is like, is there more?
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, you gotta have the next one after that.
Both series of it, all 10 books, he just like, boom, 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 one after yeah. another, because he's like, this is really good stuff.
And, oh, yeah.
So, you know, and I actually got to meet Roger Zelazny when he was here at Archon, right the year, the bit before he died, and that was one of the highlights of my con experiences, to meet him. He's always been one of my favorite writers.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that I got to meet him just, and then he died not long afterwards, mm-hmm. just like, you know, I'm just really glad that he was here, that I had that chance.
I didn't live here yet. That's very depressing to me.
Yeah. I missed meeting him by about 3 hours. I had to go out of town, and he was doing a book signing where I was living. And I couldn't make the book signing because I had to make it to the airport. Here's another little snippet of what he could do.
Mm-hmm.
This is the opening of Nine Princes in Amber. It was starting to end after what seemed most of eternity to me. I attempted to wriggle my toes and succeeded. I was sprawled there in a hospital bed and my legs were done up in plaster casts, but they were still mine. I squeezed my eyes shut and opened them 3 times. The room grew steady. Where the hell was I? Then slowly the fogs were slowly broken and some of that which is called memory returned to me. I recalled knights and nurses and needles. Every time things would begin to clear a bit, somebody would come in and jab me with something. That's how it had been, yeah. Now, though I was feeling halfway decent, they'd have to stop, wouldn't they? The thought came to assail me. Maybe not. What a beginning.
Yeah, that first sentence. I mean...
and the thing I love about the Corwin cycle, too...
End to end.
the thing I love about the Corwin cycle is that clearly he was making it up as he went along. And it works. I mean, I've always said that when he wrote those, it's like when Harlan would write a story and tape the pages to the glass where he was working so people could be reading it, but he couldn't go back and change anything. It's there. Well, he wrote this in 5 volumes, and so he you know, he tells the story of the car accident in the first couple of books based on where he's intending the story to go then. But of course, you know, probably into the second, third book, the story starts to go in a different direction. And so he has to go back and say, oh, now I found out it was a different story of how I had the car accident. And that he changes it like two or three times. And then later on, he finally just, I think in Course of Chaos, he finally just says, when he tells, you know, Merlin the story, he says, I was telling him about a story involving something and something and multiple versions of a car accident. How he actually admits multiple versions, you know.
I was garbed all in the color of Moby Dick and vanilla ice cream. Ugly. Because, of course, Corwin is black and silver.
Yeah. He doesn't want to be in white. That's Julian.
It's not an accident that
there you go. There you go.
It's just not an accident.
You should
see
half my wardrobe in my closet at home.
Yeah.
I liked it when he went to go buy clothes, and the trade is like, look, it was a silvery gray, black type thing, whatever. Why he chose the colors, he didn't know.
He didn't know, but he just...
He knew they were right.
Right to him.
Yeah.
You know?
Another line from Nine Princes that I love is, then sleep came over me. It was a big black thing about 9 hours long.
He was always turning phrases like that.
That's I think a direct connection to the world of Elizabethan drama.
Yeah,
because Turner and Shakespeare and Marlowe and Johnson and all of those people, they lived by the turned phrase. Mm. And if you think about how many phrases from that time period we still use, it's unbelievable.
If we ask at all, we decide it's either Shakespeare or the King James Bible, but they're not.
it's somewhere.
Yeah.
There's also when Random is in the bathroom, there's that echo of the Godfather. I don't want my little brother coming out of the bathroom with just his in his hand.
I'd forgotten about that.
Random is intimately involved with a urinal when the bad guys with claws transport themselves into the bathroom.
Something he doesn't revisit until two books later, and that was the thing that always threw me off. The first time I read Sign of the Unicorn, I was reading chapter 2, and I'm going, wait, since when does Corwin play the drums and hang glide? What? And then I was like, oh, and that's the only chapter in all the books where a different person is the first person narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd originally planned for each book to be narrated by a different prince.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally just said, I'm just going to stick with Corwin, which I'm glad he did, because Corwin is such an engaging character. And the funny thing is, by the time you finish the first book, you don't like the other brothers or sisters very much, so you don't really want to read their books anyway. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. The only one you like at all is Random.
Random, yeah.
Dysfunctional family.
And Deirdre.
No, yeah.
Deirdre.
Thank
you. The most. Deirdre. We can't give short shrift to Deirdre. We like Deirdre, too.
Yes.
We maybe like Deirdre a little too much.
Well, that could be.
I was saying that's the reason it took me so long to write Baranak, is because when I wrote Lucian, it was in the first person of, and in the Lucian book, Baranak is kind of the heavy for at least a good part of the story, and you don't like him very much. And so when I said I'd always said the next book's gonna be Baranak and we'll see things from the other perspective, it was very hard for me to ever get sympathetic enough in my own mind. I'm like, I don't want to be in his head for 3 or 4 months now. You know, several years had to go by before I could find a way to be sympathetic to the guy that in the other one. You know, they have very much a Loki-Thor relationship, and if the first book you write is all from Loki's point of view, you really don't want to get in Thor's head, you know? You're just like, I don't like that guy. He's a big, dumb fighter. I don't want to, you know, so that's why I'm kind of glad he stuck with Corwin all the way through.
What was the name of the book that came out just before the first of Nine Princes?
That would have been about 69. A lot of his stuff came out in the late 60s.
It would be easier to talk about it if we remembered its name.
Nine Princes came out in 70, so it would be right... 68,
69. This was...
My Name is Legion. My Name is Legion.
My Name is Legion is the one with the three short stories in it.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. That's not
Home is the Hangman.
Yeah.
About.
it's something, I don't remember it very well, but it always felt to me like it was a subconscious preview for Nine Princes.
Jack of Shadows. Yes, you're exactly right. It has a lot of similarities.
It's like the apotheosis of what you're talking about the science fiction and fantasy, because mm-hmm. you have a world, mm-hmm. one half of the world is a fantasy world, and one half of the world is a science fiction world. Mm-hmm. And he, through the course of the world of the book, lives in them both mm-hmm. and ends up bringing them together.
Which is what Changeling is about, too. But yeah. Changeling would be considered young adult today mm-hmm. if it came
yeah.
out today.
Yeah. And it was the Locus Fantasy Award nominee.
Yeah.
And now it would be a YA.
It would be YA. Yeah. Mad One, too, although it's a little more grown up.
Dilvish the Damned is a fix-up novel.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Dilvish stuff is also in that same thread, yeah. right? Yeah. Dilvish is a very Corwin-like character.
Yes.
His other novel, Lord of Light, which seemed to take a really strange turn.
Well,
which is that?
Lord of Light.
Yeah, we were.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because I came.
Oh, you just came in. Yeah, we talked about that a little bit. The whole pun thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, Walt was saying the whole book was built around the pun. I did not realize that was the entire purpose of the exercise.
According to Bob Silverberg, it's not true.
Okay.
Oh. But according to everybody else who knew them both, it is true. But Silverberg's alive, and most of the rest of them are not anymore.
Well, there you go.
So he's going to wind up running the show. The pun, of course, is "and the fit hit the Shan," which is on about page 90 or so.
It's on in there. Yeah, I remember when
the novel.
Well, I remember when he introduced the Shan character, and I thought, shouldn't that be Shah or something? And so I was already thinking, something's not right here, but I didn't ever dare dream that he was going there.
And then he does.
And I was just like, I went, and I read a sentence again, I'm like, oh,
no!
Oh, man, no.
Yeah, but that's why it's a good pun.
Good.
We rate puns by the number of groans.
And yeah, that was echoed down through the decades.
Oh, yeah. The thing about Lord of Light is that even though it was written around a pun, he used it to do wonderful social commentary.
Yeah.
And it's really very deep. The discussions that Sam has with the Rakshasa are fascinating, because humanity has come to this planet, and in the millennia before the story takes place, the first from vanished Uroth have bound all of the original inhabitants of the planet into this well of souls, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he needs an army, so he goes and releases them, provided that they will agree to fight for him. The pantheon is fascinating, the way he uses it, and he makes it a science-based pantheon. You don't know how they make these bodies that they switch. But you know they can do it. And you know that they can make superheroes. These people have aspects and attributes. If you read a lot of Zelazny, like Lord of Light, like Nine Princes and Amber, and then you start looking at television shows, movies, novels, since then, you have shadow traveling. You have the one true reality from which everything else is a shadow. That's a trope. That's a basic science fiction trope now. And you have body switching. You have one of the coolest things he talks about in Lord of Light is a gun that sprays cyanide and DMSO. The DMSO is obviously to get the cyanide in through the skin as fast as possible. But all of these things are things that we see in other writers and in other media, and we don't know why. The reason is because Zelazny did it, and it has just echoed. He's one of the, my belief, five core science fiction writers in the last half of the 20th century. John Brunner is another one who virtually no one knows anymore.
Yeah.
John Brunner.
Zanzibar.
Oh, I didn't hear the name.
John Brunner.
Yes.
Brunner and what's his name that wrote Future Shock? Alvin Toffler. We're close friends. And so Brunner wrote a novel based on Future Shock.
Shockwave.
Called The Shockwave Rider. And if you go through The Shockwave Rider and just tick off all the things that he got right, from mobile phones to programming viruses and worms on your mobile phone, to it being harder and harder and harder to afford a quality education, on and on and on. And Zelazny did a lot of the same things. He got the vision right. And that's, I think, why he resonates.
Zelazny is Amber, and everything else is the shadows of him.
Yes.
There's an awful lot of shadows of Zelazny.
Right.
Right.
Because people try to write the way he did. I certainly do. I'll probably die trying to write the way Roger Zelazny wrote. And I'll never be anywhere near as good as it.
But it's a good start to hit your wagon, too.
Oh, yeah.
John Gregory Betancourt certainly tried to.
Yes, and not well.
He did about as well as in any mid-level. That's the three prequel books that came out about 15 years ago, I guess. Yeah. 12, 15 years ago. Yeah. I mean, it's if you really, really, really love Led Zeppelin, and then you go, like, listen to Kingdom Come, then you're like, well, it's not Led Zeppelin, but it kind of sounds like him, so I guess it's fun. Same thing with those three books. You're back in Amber, you've got Oberon, you've got Dworkin, you've got Courts of Chaos. So, you know, it's not written by Zelazny. In fact, you know, the two authors, I've said this before in various panels, that the two authors that could have stepped up and done something with his stuff are Stephen Brust and Neil Gaiman.
Yep.
And they both are on record as saying, we will never touch Roger's stuff. They were friends, they respect him, they won't do it. So it fell to somebody who had fewer scruples about it
to come in and actually do it. The only person who has done a Zelazny pastiche that was actually good was Jane Linscott.
Well, I mean, she finished several of his books too.
They were living together. And,
exactly.
She managed to get into his mind and figure out how to do it.
The Chinese, that's the other one I was trying to think of about pantheons.
The Chinese pantheon.
The Chinese pantheon. The book he wrote half of, and then Jane Linscott wrote the other half. She does a serviceable job with it, but honestly, the first half that he wrote right before he died is so good. And it's once again an immortal, smart alecky character, but it's a Chinese character who
is actually a demon lord.
Lord Demon. That's it. Yeah, Lord Demon. Yeah. Who's got a dragon in a bottle or something. They have like a world inside a bottle. Again, it's been a while since I read it, but it's got all of his stuff is there. You're like, even in his last few days, he was still hitting right on all cylinders.
Yeah. The Last Defender of Camelot is terrific.
Yeah.
My vote for the most outrageously creative title of a science fiction story ever, even beating out Harlan Ellison, is The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth.
Oh, yes.
And The Doorways in the Sand, too, which I like that.
That's another incredible. The guy was just unbelievable. And for those of you who don't know, a long lost Roger Zelazny novel was found in 1999. It's not a science fiction novel. It's actually
a noir murder mystery.
Yeah, it's a noir murder mystery. It's called
The Dead Man's Brother.
Thank you. It came out of Hard Case Crime.
Put it out. I haven't read it yet. I've got it on my bookcase.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's got that Zelazny touch.
Yeah.
I
heard
and,
some.
And it fit. I mean, his character that you were talking about is not all that different from a Raymond Chandler character.
Right. No, that's exactly. That makes sense.
Him doing it.
You're exactly right. Yeah. Corwin, they've always said that Corwin is the bastard child of Raymond Chandler and
Dashiell Hammett.
And a fantasy, but you know, in a fantasy type writer together. Yeah. And that's the thing that makes the Amber series to me so special. Is that it has toes in so many different worlds at this literally, right? At the same time, you know, it's a science fiction story, it's a fantasy story, it's a theology story, it's a family dysfunctional, you know, to the nth degree. That's where Gaiman got the murderous brothers in Stardust was straight out of Amber, you know, the ones that throw each other out the window and all that. I mean, those are the Amber brothers. I guess the only other brother, the only other family member that he doesn't dislike is Gerard. We forgot about Gerard.
Yeah, I always like the fact that
he doesn't like Gerard. He just trusts Gerard more than the other.
Has godlike powers, but they weren't completely godlike and invincible. They had their flaws.
Oh,
it's just which made them human, if you want to call it that, whatever. They weren't perfect by a long shot, but and it just made them really interesting characters.
And they were pretty bad. I mean, one of the things I love about Corwin is that I love that he maintains throughout the five books that he's a good guy and everything he does is virtuous. You know, trust me at all times. I am the soul of virtue and all that. And yet, as you read it that first time, you start thinking, I think he's kind of spinning a little bit. I think he's kind of casting himself in a good light. And as you go further along, you realize before the amnesia, he was not that good of a guy. He was as nasty as any of them, you know. Because everybody he encounters from before is like, oh, it's that horrible Corwin guy. He's made a bad impression.
I'm scared and that
Kill him before he gets us.
Yeah.
Blind spot or whatever. Or woman's found. Amnesia's got all these tattoos on her, whatever, and yet she's getting flashbacks. She was not a nice person at all, necessarily. She was doing some pretty nasty stuff, but that's not who she is at the moment.
Right.
You know, so the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's being used today.
The other thing that he does that I wanted to make sure we get in is he brings that sort of smart alecky, you know, noir kind of snappy dialogue to scenes that no other writer ever really had done that before. Like, he'll have a guy with a sword facing a demonic monster in a cave, and every other writer would be like, you know, foul beast, stand back before my... And he's like, hey, buddy, what's up? You know, let's... And they'll have a little snappy repartee. And I just remember as a teenager reading that stuff and going, this is so different, right, from anything else I've seen before. The monsters are as hip as the the protagonist, you know.
Yeah. In The Night in the Lonesome Walk, we were talking about religious and mythos.
Yeah.
The Night in the Lonesome October is, of course, the Cthulhu mythos. Because
so he hit all the highlights, basically.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if there was anything left.
Norse mythology and the Mast of Loki. Yeah. Psychoanalysis and the Arthurian mythos in The Dream Master.
Yeah.
Chinese mythology and Lord Demon.
Lord Demon, yeah. In fact, Lord of Light, I teach a course at Southwestern Illinois on religion, among other things, and that's one of the books that I tell my students about and encourage them to check out and maybe do for a paper.
Easier to read than the Rig Veda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I say basically when we're studying Hinduism and Buddhism, this is a good book to kind of read. It'll, you know, if you're into that kind of thing. I don't foist it on people that aren't going to read because they're not going to understand. You know, but if you like that kind of thing, I hold it out to them. So every now and then somebody reads it. So let's see, we got about 5 minutes left. Any questions from the audience we haven't already covered or anything we've?
I'm trying to remember, isn't Zelazny, Chris Roger? somebody asked him where he got his ideas from, and he said he puts a plate of milk and some cookie crackers out on the back porch, and in the morning those are gone and ideas are there.
He said different things.
I thought he said that one time in an interview or whatever.
That's like Misty Lackey's post office box in Schenectady, where you send them an SASE and they send you 7 plot lines.
Right.
I was teaching a seminar and I said that, and somebody put up their hand, what's an SASE?
Oh!
And then I told them, and they said, well, they don't do that anymore. It's all done on the internet now.
Yeah, there's a website you send it to now. Yeah, that's one thing about if you're wanting to write, not only emulating Zelazny or reverse engineering him like I did when I was younger, but also he wrote a number of essays, more than a couple, on writing, you know, at different stages in his career, and you find him tucked into some of those anthologies, mm-hmm. like Ice and Fire, maybe, and Last Defender of Camelot. There's several different anthologies that contain a bunch of his stories. They're in here too, of course, in those 6 volumes, and he really kind of goes into how he develops ideas, how he figured, and that was, you know, enormously influential too. It's like him sitting next to you and kind of giving you hints and clues. Yeah.
One of the things that fascinated me, one of those, a collection of short stories there years and years ago, I don't remember which one, but he said that every time he writes a novel, before he writes the novel, he takes one of the characters, usually the main character, but not necessarily, and he writes a short story.
Yes.
About that character.
Yes.
That takes place before the novel, and then he shelves it. He doesn't
just to get to know him.
Publish it anywhere. It's just to get into that character's head. Now I'm ready to write the novel.
Right, rather than having it happen as you actually write.
Mm-hmm.
Right, actually, because, yeah, I've certainly had that experience where you start writing a book and you get to about chapter 3 and now you're getting the feel of the characters, and so you start thinking, do I need to go back and rewrite 1 and 2 now that I know them better? And he just skipped right ahead and did that story and it put him... I know, I wish we could read those.
I'd like
an anthology of stuff that he pre-wrote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When I read that essay, I was like, where are these stories? I want to read all of them.
Where's the Francis Sandow pre-Isle of the Dead story? Yeah, that's exactly.
But he shelved them because that's where he was digging and he didn't want to waste our time on the digging.
Well, one thing that he said along those lines, though, that I always found suspicious is he said that he writes his short stories by basically writing the last chapter of a novel and leaving out everything else. And I always felt like he was being a little facetious there, because I think that there's more to it than just coming in at the very last reel of the movie. I'm like, well, maybe you kind of did that. But
if you look at the places where he took a short story and then built a novel out of it, like
This Immortal
is one.
And of course it's gone.
Dreammaster
was the big one, yeah.
If you look at Damnation Alley, it's a much better short story than it is a novel, even though there's cool stuff that he added in the novel.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It also kind of pads it out and it lessens the impact.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was Dreammaster that he said he kept adding to it, and then the editor or the publisher, whoever, say, well, it needs to be a little bit longer. He's like, he finally told him, there's nothing left that I can add that won't start making it worse, right? He said, I've added stuff to make it better, but now it'll start getting worse, so.
Well, we're about out of time.
Yeah, so I think we've done him justice. I appreciate you guys coming out and got all the great questions and comments. Thank you.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.